This is Jim Adell. You are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Good afternoon. This is the Living Writer Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm Amanda Yulee, sitting in for T. Hetzel, who is the regular host of this program. And we're taping a show this afternoon. It's the last day of 2018, New Year's Eve. And we are very pleased to have joining us via phone Leland de la Durantay. Hello, Leland.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I shouldn't say what I'm about to say, but it's really an honor to be on Ann Arbor Radio. I grew up in East Lansing, which I loved, but I always thought of Ann Arbor as a particularly glam, sophisticated place, even though I had to sometimes keep that to myself. And so it's a life dream and a pleasure.
You don't have to keep it to yourself today. Today is the day you can be very proud to be on Ann Arbor Radio. And it may be the first day that someone has called us from Los Angeles calling Ann Arbor glam. So thank you for that. Good way to end 2018, glamorously. Leland, you are the author of a novel, Hannah Versus the Tree, published by McSweeney's this year. And I would love for you, this is your first novel. I would love for you to introduce the book for our listeners who maybe have not read it yet.
Absolutely. So the first thing I could say about it is that it's short. And I don't just say that so that people think about picking it up because it won't represent such a gigantic time investment for them. It's relevant in that it's a voice speaking or writing that is trying to compel, that is trying not to lose the attention of someone, and it's a really highly charged voice speaking more or less in a continuous session of thought. Doesn't need to be imagined as being composed in a single session, but in a relatively condensed period of time in a highly emotional state. It's called Hannah Versus the Tree. The Hannah of the title is its heroine, and she's a heroine in a strong sense, which is to say, if I were to describe the book generally as though it weren't mine, it's the story of a heroic individual, of a heroine, of somebody who is really incredible in a number of regards. And even for those people who are most close to her and have been closest to her entire life, she's very surprising in what she can do. She has she's a genius, or her genius manifests in a number of ways, and it makes her very unpredictable. So in a very sort of typological sense, she would be like Odysseus or Achilles, someone with a very unusual nature, a very unusual gift, very unusual capacities. The next thing that the book is obviously about is the tree part. The book is a story of vengeance. And the tree is a family tree. Hannah's resisting part of her own family, a very powerful part of her own, very powerful family. And so it describes a great act of vengeance. The thing that is perhaps least immediately obvious, but for me most significant, is that it's about love. It's written in the key of love, in the tone of love, in the voice of love. The narrator loves Hannah and has since he was a child. And so while it has one side which is involves a lot of conflict. There is another side which involves a lot of concord. And for me, therefore, it's to a significant extent about love, about the feeling of love and about the description of love.
I really, that sense of love came through very strongly for me as a reader, for sure. I mean, I found all of the sort of action in the book and the plot points fascinating, but almost secondary to what I felt was a real adoration that the narrator had for Hannah. And I thought about that relationship. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah, that makes me happy to hear. In part because it corresponds to how the book grew. I wrote it in a relatively brief period of time, which is to say a year, or just over a year. I'm a professor of comparative literature, and I was on sabbatical in Rome, meant to be translating Italian philosophy, and instead writing Hannah. And as I was writing it, I didn't know what I was writing. I didn't know the story or the plot points so much as I knew the tone of voice that was going to be writing about Hannah. And I only learned the plot relatively late in the process of writing the book. And so it is intuitive and natural to me that it would be first experienced as a statement of love, though, of course, it's the most visible plot point. If someone were to give you the architecture of its plot, it wouldn't necessarily seem that way.
Right. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about what I think is a very unusual and beautiful structure that the book has with that narrator's voice. Can you speak to that and maybe describe it a little bit for us?
Sure, yeah. So the narrator is addressing someone in the book. And initially, you don't know exactly whom or exactly why. And as the book progresses, it becomes clear why the speaker is, or why the narrator is addressing this person, who's Hannah's grandmother. That structure came to me, or seemed the best. That, too, came relatively late. I could take a step back and say something larger about the composition of the book. I'm 46, and I have been trying to write this book since I was 4, more or less. I've always wanted to write a novel. I've always wanted to write a book like this.
Did you say since you were 4?
Yeah, or whenever I was first having a notebook to scribble in.
Wow. 42 years in the making.
I remember in East Lansing, Michigan, when I was 4, getting a notebook for Christmas, so right around this time of year, and I just learned to write. I was filling it up initially with my name and my parents' names and the names mm-hmm. of the dogs and the cats and the rabbit and the things of my world, but I didn't really have much of a story to tell. You know, I hadn't been alive that long, and I couldn't really write. So I remember filling it, however, even at the end, with a kind of Cy Twombly-ing script, just to have there be ink on every line. And feeling, when I was done with the little notebook that I'm given, that I was done, that I'd written a book, felt really good. And I, for my adolescence, for my early youth, I was studying philosophy, I was studying languages. I was living in Germany for many years, and France for years, and in Italy for years, and learning philosophy. But in my heart, what I was really doing, or thinking about doing, what I was really here to write, was to write a novel. And during that time, I tried many times. I had many abortive projects. One that got so far as to have an offer from a press that wanted to publish it. It wasn't complete. I could mm-hmm. see that I couldn't complete it. It really had a flaw at its core that was really too insidious. So I didn't take the offer, and I never finished that novel, and I never finished any of the other projects that I was often working on. And so what was different about this experience is that I completed it. I don't really know how. I can guess, I can speculate why this time it worked and on previous occasions it didn't. But to come back to the structure of the novel, in the past I had been able to string together passages of prose which I liked or found interesting or compelling, and or could be proud of in some way. But it didn't cohere. It wasn't a story. It wasn't really a book. And somehow with Hannah, I was able to find a structure with a certain sort of mythic outline to it and a certain set of recurrences. There's a little bit like in a musical piece, there are movements in it, and there, mm-hmm. there are rhythmic returns. There's a word, and there's also a kind of emotion that recurs at rhythmic points. And those allowed me to have a structure for it, and allowed me relatively late in my year to see a way that I could complete it. The book's much shorter than I imagined it being. I had a lot of material, and I suddenly saw a way that it could coalesce, that it could cohere, and that made me intensely happy. And completing it itself was like when I completed this notebook when I was 4. It was a really unusual, intense feeling. I've translated 3 books, and I've written 3 books of philosophy and criticism, and it didn't feel at all like those things. They felt good, but they were very different. So this has been a really unique experience for me. I'm sorry to be so long-winded about it.
Not at all. I actually want to hear more about that feeling and that difference between completing a book, a nonfiction book, or completing a translation, and then completing a novel. Can you talk more about that? That's such a fascinating difference.
Absolutely. The first book I wrote is called Style is Matter, and it's about Nabokov. And then I wrote a book about a great Italian philosopher, Giorgio Agamben, the greatest living philosopher, and a book about Samuel Beckett called Beckett's Art of Mismaking. And in each case, I was really intensely emotionally engaged with the material, but it wasn't about my emotion. My emotion was in the background. It was what motivated the project. But what I was trying to do was, for example, in the case of Agamben, present the scope of his thought, the relations between his very varied concerns. He's an unusual philosopher in that he's very interested in poetry as well as in legal history and as well as in ancient philosophy, and the list goes on and on. And so I was trying to make his intellectual world intelligible to a reader and to highlight what was so particularly brilliant about his work. And so it was really about curating someone else's creation and to help it, to serve it, to further it. And all those were really strongly powerful feelings, and they were very like the feelings that I was having in the classroom when I was teaching in graduate school. I taught at Harvard for 8 years, and now I've taught at the Claremont Colleges for 5 years. So those were experiences like ones that I was having in the classroom. But to write something purely of myself, from myself, is completely different. It's daunting in many ways, because I won't be able to say, well, I wrote that because someone else wrote something, or that chapter is the way it is because Beckett's late work is the way it is. Anything that was in the book, it was up to me to justify it, to understand it, and to be its author. I was much more an author in writing this book, and it's, as I said, it's very of me. The things that happen in it, they're not from my life at all, but every little bit of it, sometimes it appears to me like a mosaic, and every little mosaic stone in it is a bit of my experience. Might be experience reading, it might be experience firsthand, but it's full of little live cells of emotion, and so my relationship to it is really highly charged, which leads to a strange dichotomy. I am uncomplicatedly proud of it and happy at its sight.
As you should be.
In a way that I was sort of proud. I mean, I was proud of these other books and of the books that I translated as well. I'm very proud. But there was a distance. I don't expect everyone to like it, and so I think the prospect of criticism was less daunting for me. For example, when I was I am very, very proud to be published by McSweeney's, and I was absolutely delighted when I got McSweeney's letter. I had prior to that, in the preceding weeks, got some other letters that some were just curt no's. And some were longer nose, and I realized that it didn't hurt my pride, or it didn't threaten me or make me feel bad in a way that the prior rejections had, because I saw that what I had made was a somewhat unusual thing, and that it wouldn't necessarily be for everyone, but that I definitely didn't want to change it. It definitely was as it should be for me. And that made the entire process much easier, emotionally speaking, than these other projects where I could always negotiate with the editor who wanted more about this or less about that.
Right. You may be an unusual fiction writer, though, to be as detached as you sound from the emotions of rejection and acceptance and other things. That's incredible.
Well, I've had a lot of experience. I mean, in academia, it gives you a lot of experience in failure. You're constantly sort of proposing things, submitting things.
And being told no or no thank
you.
Yeah, that happens. Well, I think we should do a break and have a quick song. We are speaking today on the Living Writers Show to Leland de la Durantaye. He is author of Hannah Versus the Tree. We're so glad you're here joining us, Leland, today. And here's Tame Impala. Welcome back. It's the Living Writers Show on WCBN-FM, Ann Arbor. I'm hosting today Amanda Yulee, and we are happy to have Frank Yulee as our able engineer across the window from me here. And we're on the phone today by novelist Leland de la Durantaye. Hello, Leland.
Hi there.
Thanks again for being here in, as you say, glamorous Ann Arbor.
My pleasure.
Via phone. So we're talking about your novel, Hannah Versus the Tree. And I was, I'm hoping that in a moment or two, you'll read some for us. I'm especially interested in our listeners sort of hearing how not just the ideas in the book come together, but the, in my opinion, very poetic way the sentences are put together and the way the book unfolds that way, sort of moment by moment. Can you actually talk a little bit about that? Before you read, sort of that micro level of how you approached sentence by sentence this beautiful text.
Absolutely, and thank you to call it so. What I do think that I have an somewhat unusual process for a fiction writer, but would be a totally usual and normal process for a poet. In that when I sit down to write, I don't know what I'm doing. Any given session of writing, the sessions of writing that led to Hannah, which were basically every day in Rome for a year, I would sit down and just free associate or just write whatever came into my head for a certain amount of time, maybe an hour. Sometimes if it was a particularly good wind, I would write for two. And then I would set it aside and I would look at prior sessions. And most of what I saw I would throw away. But sometimes I would see the beginning of something. And it wasn't just the beginning of an idea or of a scene. It was always the beginning of a sentence or an image or a relationship between images or some bit of actual writing. So the story itself grows from those bits of actual writing, which I think would be counterintuitive for some novelists who would first, sort of like Balzac, envisage the whole society in which it takes place, know exactly the historical moment, know what every planet like a battle, and then write it. And so that seems to be really dramatic and fun, but I'm incapable of it. It's really foreign to my writing nature.
You're not the planet out on index cards and, you know, make it all make sense in advance of the writing part type.
No. I even have a little difficulty sometimes with my own students because it's really a temperamental question. Some students think as they write, find what they have or want to say in the saying of it, in the writing of it.
Right.
And some plan in advance, and both modes are equally valid, and there's a lot of people between the poles. I'm pretty close to one of the poles, and so when I have students who really love to plan and are really planning out, say, a senior thesis, I have to work mentally so hard to get into their planning space because that's even my own academic work didn't proceed in that manner.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that my girlfriend, Alison, thinks that I basically know what I'm doing, but I'm keeping it a secret for myself for the excitement of it, that I am dimly aware of everything, but I can't let myself in on it.
I like that theory. That's a wonderful approach for those of us who like to fall into our writing the way that you're talking about. That's wonderful.
It is very reassuring instead of sort of stumbling around in the dark of myself that actually I know what I'm doing.
You do.
I just don't have crystalline consciousness of it the whole time.
Well, what you said before about the writing itself, the process of writing and getting words on a page being how those thoughts emerge and how those ideas that are there just sort of come to the light is a good one.
Right. I guess that's the entire question. Thank you for saying it that way. Now I understand it better. It's basically the question that presents itself in lots of domains. Is there discovery or invention? Like in mathematics, is the solution to some theorem. Did it always exist and it was hidden, like gold underground? Somebody just had to find it, or did they have to invent it? For the structure of a story, is it the story that everyone has a story deep inside of themselves that they just have to discover? They're not inventing it; they have to find it in themselves. Would be one model. Whereas the other, that they really, that thing does not exist yet. It has it only has a potential existence, and you have to make it exist. And there's no predetermined way for it to exist.
And you make it exist through working hard and planning and all those other things that we were talking about, right?
Yeah. The only way, I don't think you can know. You can just pick whichever model seems less anxiety provoking
for you,
and have that be the theory of what's going on. And I suppose the most energizing thing is that I would have to materialize it out of nothing. And the most tranquilizing thing would be basically Proust's idea that you just have to translate it out of yourself or out of your soul. It's in there. It's mm-hmm. always been in there. You just have to learn to translate.
We are speaking today on the Living Writer Show with Leland de la Darentaille. Leland, would you like to read a little bit from maybe the beginning portion of the book, if you
Happily.
Like?
Happily.
Okay. Is this the very beginning?
Yeah, this is the very beginning.
Okay.
Did you really think she wouldn't come for you in the night, like you came for so many during so many nights? Had you really thought they were all just rumors about what she was and what she could do? It appears that you did, just as it appears that you no longer do. I am, as your lawyers suggest, perhaps no more than a spoiled, petulant child who knows so little of the world that it is breathtaking. On the other hand, you are an old woman who lives so far removed from the world, separated by firewalls of wealth, as to live apart from it. Who is to say which of us understands less, except about the matter at hand? Thus your offer. In exchange for the dropping of all charges against all parties, even Annika, I will give you what you ask. But know that it will not be what you want, for it cannot help. It cannot better your situation, cannot slow, let alone halt, what's coming. It would indeed be difficult to imagine worse press than you are currently getting, unless, that is, the world were to see the real reason for your fall. Then it would get worse. Much. In telling the story of now, no future chronicler will fail to note this as the end of the long influence of the House of Searle. It is rare for a family to live so long, through so many generations. So much cold water and chainmail, and so many ships and wars, fracturing and healing, fusing and dividing, always resilient, until now. A family of such descent is a rare thing. Not one in a million knows it. So it will be noted. But the why is another matter. Will they know why? Will they know how Hannah, Silka, Silva, Searle brought down her entire fearsome ancient house around her, like Samson, except that she was a girl and could see and did it with her mind? That will be up to you.
Such an arresting beginning for a novel. And I think that's in part due to the perspective that you've chosen, and the content as well. And then the mystery that, I mean, as a reader, when you're first introduced to these characters, I, for one, you know, I wasn't sure who was speaking and how it would all unfold. So can you talk about how you chose to begin the book that way? And the perspective that you chose?
Yeah. As I was writing, I had been aware for some time that the book was in the second person, but I didn't know who was addressed. The person who is speaking of their love, I wasn't going to have them just speak of their love, because that would really give no shape to it, or it would require a really condensed shape. It would basically be a sonnet. And so I thought about different plot possibilities. And ultimately, what made most sense is for the narrator to be addressing Hannah's grandmother, the matriarch of this really powerful family, and in essence, the opposing general, because there's a phase of conflict which is strategic and is involving real-time, large-scale decision-making, all of it irreversible, and so a bit like a military or an ancient military conflict. And at that point in the book, Hannah is behaving quite like Hannibal of Carthage, which is, say, an utter genius, even when outnumbered. And so what's technically difficult about that is the addressee, the grandmother, she was a participant. She knows everything. And so I had to communicate to the reader that everything that both sides know. They know who Hannah is. They know what Hannah did. But the grandmother doesn't know exactly how Hannah defeated her. In fact, she doesn't understand very well at all how she was so terrifically defeated. It's beginning to dawn on her. And so the voice is, of course, outraged and aggressive in a way that not even Hannah's would be, because they're... the narrator adores Hannah, has known her since they were children, has a deep level of solidarity and allegiance, as well as a totally adult, passionate love for her. So his feelings about her are really fierce, and so the fierce tonalities of protective love are there, as well as the desire to tell her, to tell someone of the incredible thing that he saw. He was close enough to see how she won the battle, how she was able to resist in this position of disadvantage, and how she was able to reverse a huge advantage that members of her family had against her. And so he really wants to speak of it because it was so amazing. He wants to understand it himself, just as someone, if they were witness to an act of genius, so as to clarify it in their own minds how something so brilliant could happen, how someone could either be so lucky or so lucid that they were able to do something utterly extraordinary and with no wavering of confidence. She has an unusual confidence in herself. And so that is how it grew in the second person.
Well, in this, I think, beginning section especially, I was really struck by something you said and something I perceived in that part, which is that while the voice is strident and a little bit harsh, maybe at moments, it also, that power comes from the fidelity and the love that the narrator has for Hannah. And so it's both of those things really powerfully. And I think, you know, you made a comment earlier in the show about the book's length and that it is short. But my experience is that it is short, but it is as powerful sort of throughout. Do you feel like, is that a fair characterization, that intensity?
I would love for that to be a fairer characterization.
Okay. Good.
That's how it. It does feel to me, for example, like a novel, and it does seem to me complete and not a novella. It's not a story that goes on a little longer. It is a complete. It's a complete novel. It's a complete tale. And it is, in its way, relatively dense. I think it reads relatively fluidly, but its construction is relatively dense. My practice at the end was to be shaving away everything that wasn't load bearing, everything that wasn't serving the whole, and so it feels to me very close to the bone. Now it feels to me very sort of sleek.
Well, you said something earlier, I think, about when you were talking about the novel being short, and you were, maybe I get this wrong, but I think you alluded to it being a shorter time commitment or something like that. But I think I would argue that it's perhaps a much longer time commitment because of that intensity. You know, I think that I found myself reading and kind of going back and rereading a little bit. Is that how other readers have responded?
Yeah, I said it was short just because I think that, I want people to buy it. I want people to get it. And so I don't want them to think, oh, there'll be this, I'll have this magic mountain of a book that I'll never get through. But that has, the rereading has been something that readers have been telling me they were doing. I was lucky to get on a radio show called Bookworm with Michael Silverblatt in Los Angeles, and his experience was that it was like a normal novel because as soon as he finished it, he reread it, and it was ended up being sort of occupying the same mental space.
It's twice the length.
And, yeah. And so it's just like in concentrate. It's a very concentrated novel.
Probably whether you read it front to back and then again in the same way, or whether you are returning to certain passages or thinking about certain passages, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a thing that I like that Nabokov used to tell his students at Cornell and Wellesley and Harvard and Stanford and elsewhere, that he would begin this lectures on literature course by telling his students that there's no reading, only rereading. And that's obviously not true. There are lots of things that are meant to be read just once. And it could be that even there are certain things, like the books he's teaching, Ulysses and Madame Bovary, that you can only really appreciate by rereading. It's nevertheless perhaps most important what happens during that first reading, even if there's a certain amount of confusion or uncertainty that accompanies it. But I do think that if I were so lucky as to have rereaders, then I think there are certain things that might not have been so clear in the first reading that would become more clear, which is to say I think the plot admits of pretty clear comprehension, though I don't, the narrator doesn't especially emphasize certain elements that are key to the unfolding of things, simply because it would be totally implausible given the structure of the novel. So that I'm having him hide things. But for him to do all he needs to do, there are certain essential elements in their story which are stated but not underlined particularly.
And they emerge on subsequent reading. We are speaking today to Leland de la Durantay. I'm Amanda Yulee on the Living Writer Show. We're going to take a short break, and then Leland, I hope you will read again for us. I was thinking we could talk about Michigan some more.
Happily.
Okay.
Happily.
Sounds good. Thank you. And we're back on the Living Writers Show. It's WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And we're speaking to the author of Hannah Versus the Tree, Leland de la Durantay. Hi, Leland.
Hi there.
So do you have something else ready to read for us from
Yeah.
the novel? Great.
The answer to the next item on your lawyer's list is that, yes, your brother was most certainly involved in your ruin, but not as you suspect. At the divide, two individuals essential to your end entered our lives. In light of our parents' recent behavior, we regarded all adults with suspicion, with two exceptions, the old one and the wise one. The wise one, you know, as well as a sister like you can know a brother like him. The old one was my great-grandfather, and you did not have the pleasure. He was in many senses a super-adult, having lived a terrific number of adult years. And yet Hannah and I wondered whether adulthood was not something you might grow out of, for he thought as we did, and so had our trust. Rules had become for us things to break for the feeling of breaking, so as to tell the powers that be to be differently. In this we found a true ally in the old one. He lived beyond the rules of my house, beyond the rules of any house, doing and saying all sorts of things, in his limited capacity to do and say things, which were clearly subject to another law, an older one. He was grandfathered into himself, as Gabby said, and did as he pleased. One day the old one bent forward towards us, his eyebrows raised as though in outrage, and said, "I am decrepit, but I would be precious if I were a killer whale. It is normal that they do not listen to you," he said. "You don't know how things work. But it is not normal that they do not listen to me. Once the old were prized. For many mammals, for elephants, lions, wolves, the old are not just useful, they are essential. Although the old one conceded that aged females were more useful than aged males. The same applied to the people who stopped before this step in civilization," he said, "the step from hunter-gatherers to farmers." His age encouraged him to take the long view, Hannah observed. "If a tribe loses its elders, it is..." "Bleep," he said. "Bleep. Where do you find water in dry years? Which of the red berries is poisonous? What is the weakness of the tribe over the hill? What do you do when the caribou change their migration route? Where do you find salmon? How do you survive snake bite? When the aged go, the pack, the pod, the family, the tribe loses all that useful information. People think these things are on the internet," he said. "People have no idea." The next day he told us a long, forking story which involved him being somewhere far in the north, alone, in a canoe, gliding along a little creek linking two lakes, and seeing, on the shore, a great bear, drinking or fishing. It reared up, he said, and with all of itself roared at him. And he did not just hear it, he felt it vibrate through him, through the air, through the water, through the canoe, through the paddle. He looked from Hannah's eyes to mine and said, slowly, "That is the real world." We didn't think of ourselves as being on a line which, given time, even lots of it, led to him. He was too old for that. His body hardened and thinned and stiffened and worn smooth by extreme age, having grown out of frailty into something else entirely. And it is only those who have begun to age who find the old frightening. To the young, they're just exotic. The old one ate little, slowly, and with annoyance. He seemed to live from the fire of whiskey, which Hannah and I tasted once and were shocked by. A touch to the lips was enough to fill your whole head with fire. And this was the old one's water, Hannah said in wonder. The old one's place in the family was fixed by my father. He had taught my father the names of the trees and how to track animals, taught him the forests and the lakes, the winds and the currents, taught him to canoe, to sail, shoot, start fires, and be an animal among animals. The old one taught my father all the things he had failed to teach his own son. I don't know them either. They skip generations. In return for making him a man, my father revered the old one. When his ancientness, as Gabby called him, asked my father to kill him with a pillow in his nursing home, saying it wouldn't be hard, saying he would rather die than live another day with all these dying strangers, My father took him and installed him in our house like an idol. For nothing in the world would my father have wanted his parents or his siblings or any other member of his family in his house for more than absolutely necessary. But the old one is different. The old one was a delight. The old one had wintered in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan as a boy, been around the Great Lakes, moved along the shore of Lake Superior into Canada. He had been to Hudson Bay, above the Arctic Circle. He had been charged by a bear. He had killed moose. He knew a great deal about foxes. He explained to us in detail the guns of his youth. It took time to load them, he said. You had one shot. If you shot at a moose or a bear and did not kill it, he said, it would charge and kill you before you had time to reload. And the killing would be very animal, he said. Now it is all different. Now there are degenerates who shoot them out of helicopters with assault weapons. They would not do that here, he said, staring furiously at an old rifle on the wall. The old one had killed his own before, in World War I. It was a thing he had been made to do, he said. Never kill anyone, he said to us in a way that was intense, given that we were seven, and interesting, given that one day we would.
Thank you, Leland. That was a selection from Hannah versus the Tree, Leland De La Durantay's novel out with McSweeney's this fall. You reference Michigan so many beautiful ways, the Upper Peninsula and otherwise, in the book and in that passage. Can you tell us a bit about how you came to choose Michigan as the setting for so much of the book?
Sure. So the simplest answer is I was born into it.
Yes.
I'm a real Michigander, and I'm from East Lansing. My parents are from Detroit or from the greater Detroit area. Uh-huh. My father's father is very interested in genealogy, and so had traced our family's presence in what is today Michigan to before the country existed, when it was New France. And so there was a lot of family interest in Michigan and also in Ontario and in Quebec, but especially in Michigan as a notion. But also my parents, who were hippies and had me when they were very young, when they were students at Michigan State University, or my dad had just finished and my mom was finishing undergraduate, they were 24 and 23, they would travel around a lot, and we would go to different points in the Upper Peninsula and lots of places in the Northern Peninsula, to lots of different lakes, different points on Lake Michigan. And so a lot of my youth was in the northern parts of Michigan, Upper and Lower Peninsula. And so that really has always fired my imagination. It's always sort of it's the way I first began to think about the natural world and its power and its danger and its fascination. My mother is Ottawa, and so when I was a child, I had a sort of really mystical, magical attachment to and conflicted attachment to Michigan, because on my father's side were these colonial people from France, even if they were colonials of long date or colonizers of long date. And my mother was, as I said, Ottawa. And mm-hmm. and though they represented different modes of knowing the forest, of knowing the lakes, of knowing the rivers, they represent different attitudes of what you were doing on there. The French, of course, were trading fur and maintaining alliances with different tribes so as to counter the force of the English. It was a kind of grand game. And, of course, the Ottawa had a very different experience of nature and of its power and of the need to preserve it, or of the responsibility to preserve it. And so basically all my ideas about the world and about nature grew in Michigan, grew listening to my parents and other people talk about it, and above all just have lots of physical experiences in different parts of Michigan. And so as I was giving my protagonists a childhood, I had to give them in some part mine, or what mm-hmm. seemed most natural and intuitive to me was to put them there. And that is the most anchored place in the book. After that, the places in the book are much less bound up with their place, and often they're not even really named.
A little less tangible than Michigan, which shines through very, very powerfully, I think, in the book.
Yeah, Michigan's the most important place in the book, for sure.
It's an important place. We can agree, right? So we are speaking today to the author of Hannah Versus the Tree, Leland de la Durante. I'm Amanda Yulee, and we're going to have a quick break and then come back. And Leland, I'd love for you to speak a little bit more about families, which is a huge theme in the book. And you touched on that in your last answer there, too. So we'll be back in a moment. And we're back with the Living Writer Show. We're speaking about the novel Hannah Versus the Tree. And there are so many beautiful themes here about family. And they're so, to me as a reader, I found them so unexpected. I think there's a grand tradition of family novels where the author kind of relies on our collective understanding about what families are and what they do. And I think, Leland, what you've done with this novel is so very different than that. Can you speak to that notion of how you saw family playing into the text here?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful question. And the truth is, it's I haven't been asked any of the questions exactly that you've asked me, but no one's even remotely asked me about this aspect of the book, and so this is my first moment of becoming aware of it.
Putting you on the spot a bit.
No, sorry. I love it. I like the spot.
Good.
There are two things that seem clear to me about it. The first is a bit easier to talk about because it's larger scale, and that is that I needed in the book, wanted a grand conflict. There had to be a huge amount of energy for a really intense conflict. And so a natural place to think about that is, of course, in families. That's where the highest intensity of emotion, generally speaking, is. It's where first emotion comes from, and it's where and in different families, there's a different understanding of what a family is. Large aristocratic families like Hannah's are enterprises, and they're, especially if they are families like hers, which are surviving different regimes, surviving a monarchical world into a republican or democratic world where their prestige and importance and power comes from political influence and from money, as opposed to from possession of land and connection to spiritual authority. And so they've been very adaptable, the Searles, the essentially Viking family of the book. So I was saying that there's a mythic level, and on the mythic level, you can have a situation that arises where one owes one thing to family, and one owes another thing to country, or to city, or to society. And obviously there's one level of allegiance that people can have, which is to family. And in many cases, I think that trumps all other allegiances for them. There's certainly a number of figures in the book who their most important relationship is to the family, and the laws of the place, or larger scale questions of equality, and conservation, preservation, fairness, disappear before the imperatives of family, before this animal love of what's your own and which you, and what's yours, what's part you. So there's this huge call of family. And there can always be difficult situations where someone is caught between the two. A really famous example, of course, is is in the Oedipus cycle of plays. Antigone is in this difficult situation, which is that the laws of family oblige her to bury her dead brother, but the laws of city forbid her to give burial to an enemy of the city. And so she's in this impossible double bind situation. She has to accommodate imperatives or demands that are from totally different domains. And so it's very difficult to know how to relate one's responsibility or feeling to family with one's responsibility to larger concerns. So one side of the book or of the drama is about how much injustice will you take because it's family? How much injustice will you turn a blind eye to because it's your family? Because there's something morally good or something that feels good about complete allegiance to family and saying the rest of the world can be as chaotic or as foreign or as unpredictable or as incomprehensible as you like. The one thing that I hold to is family. Just as there are other individuals who have a feeling for family, Hannah certainly doesn't lack it. She has a very powerful feeling of family. In fact, she wouldn't avenge herself the way she did unless she did have a powerful feeling of family. It's not that she's indifferent to it, but she's committed to changing its course. And she also has an attitude about it, which is that the goal in a family is not to preserve it from shame when it does shameful things. So I guess in a lot of ways, it's the use of family and family tensions to tell my story. But now that I think about it, it is a reflection on family and what you owe your family. And in what way do you owe your family what you owe them? In a way, you owe them life. And if you live in a more traditional society, you owe them safety and protection if you have it. And so nothing you could ever do could ever repay family for what they gave you. But, of course, there's lots of conflict when people are doing what's best for their family, but not what's best for the larger collective.
It's a supreme sort of allegiance that many people have to families. But in the case of your novel and other situations, we see people very courageously sort of breaking that allegiance. And you do that so well in the book. We're speaking to Leland de la Darantay, author of Hannah versus the Tree. We don't have a lot of time left, but Leland, what I would love to do is have you speak a little bit about maybe, I don't know if you have advice or thoughts for aspiring writers or novelists, but some of the things that have struck me most about our conversation over this last hour have been when you talked about having a notebook as a 4-year-old and wanting to be a writer and eventually becoming one and calling yourself one. And sometimes it takes time for one to develop that and develop not just the confidence and the skill, but to actualize it. Can you speak to that a little bit, especially through the lens of advice for others who maybe are not where you are in terms of completion?
Absolutely. So I can only and very humbly counsel patients. I'm really a happy, creative person at this moment in my life, and I've been a happy person at many moments in my life, happy intellectual person. But I think that I just wasn't ready. I wasn't intellectually, emotionally, and aesthetically mature enough to write a book yet. Not that I'm so very much those things now, but that the reason I couldn't complete these projects is that I really wasn't ready to. But one thing I did realize about my process was, well, there are a few things. One, to be relaxed about time. There are terrifying examples I teach, as I mentioned, comparative literature, and they're terrifying examples like Rimbaud or Keats, who are just full-fledged poets and geniuses at shockingly young ages. You know, Rimbaud is a teenager and Keats is in his early 20s. But there are also cases like Kant, who's in his mid-50s before he really gets rolling. And so everyone has, you know, their own maturation, and that's a thing, obviously, to respect in oneself. For me, when I look back at the other projects, I was always trying to do something that I thought I needed to do so that I would get to write a novel. So the project that had been most advanced, which was called Analyst Architect Accident, and which I'd had an offer for, was a detective novel. And the problem with it is that I had thought so that I could be allowed to write a novel, I had to write in a specific genre that people tended to like detective novels, something very plot-driven that would keep me on my best plot behavior so that I wouldn't just luxuriate in sensual description. And that was a bad idea for me, or showed that I wasn't ready. When I wrote Hannah for the first time in my life, I was only writing Hannah. I was meant to be, I completely suspended this translation project that I was working on.
You've mentioned that a few times. Did you do the translation?
Yeah,
yes.
I finished it. But I set it aside and didn't take anything else on and let every writing day stand or fall with writing Hannah. And then this sounds really cliched, but it's the first time I succeeded because it's the first time I could have really failed. I always had an alibi before that I wasn't really doing it. I was also doing this other thing. Whereas here, if at the end of that year, if I flew back from Rome at the end of the year without anything completed, that would have just been a failure. It wouldn't have been the end of the world, but it would have meant that I tried to do this thing that I hadn't been able to do. And that pressure, that when I was writing, it was all I was doing, that all my best energy went into it, that even when I wasn't feeling that well, I would do it, that I would commit to the program, commit to the project fully, was a new thing for me. And so I could say, well, I've finally been able to complete something because I've reached the age at which I'm mature. It also could be that I finally gave myself the conditions for completion, which was total engagement and risk, real emotional risk.
And a bit of a deadline. If you wanted to write it while you were away, that was for a finite period of time, right?
Yeah. Once I left Rome, I would be coming back, and I have the honor to be chair of my department. I knew that I wasn't chair right away, but I just knew that many responsibilities, teaching, but various responsibilities at the college were going to consume my time in a new way, and so that if I didn't finish it there, it was really unlikely that I would.
I think it's great advice for writers who are beginning that path or who are somewhere on that path, to add that as self-imposed pressure, if you will. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you... I talked to a lot of writers who are also teaching, and many find that impossible to do together or concurrently. Do you write your own work while you're teaching and grading and editing student work?
I do. I do, though. The ends of the semester are really tight, and so there's very little of it. There are different lulls in the rhythms of semesters, and so when, say, there's a point where all my students are writing, but they haven't handed in their essays yet, and so I'm sort of waiting for a big batch of something, or I happen to finish a set of readings for class early. I do know that I get this treat, so to speak. I get to work. I get to write a little bit. I have the good fortune in this regard that I teach literature rather than writing. I think that emotionally speaking, I don't think that I could teach writing. Period. But if I tried, I think it would be very hard to write and be teaching writing at the same time. And so it's a little bit easier in that I'm writing about I'm talking to them about Ulysses rather than myself. And so it's really a time game for me. It's not an intellectual or emotional game. I'm eager to write. I like to write every day, if I can, even if it's just for half an hour in the train or something, just to like doing fingering exercises for the piano or something, just to sort of keep my hand, and also to feel connected to the project as it's growing by checking in. So sometimes I might go as many as 3 or 4 days in a busy week without spending any time with that kind of writing. But I usually stop. I usually check in. I usually do a little bit during the semester. Though for my first years of teaching, I didn't do